A little bouncer slowly toward Bryant. He will glove it and throw to Rizzo. It's in time! And the Chicago Cubs win the World Series!
I remember running home from school, turning on the TV to the Cubs game, sitting with my dad to watch his heroes.
Welcome to the World Series Dreaming Chicago Cubs Dreamcast, now hanging out with Obstructive View. We are not affiliated with the actual Chicago Cubs, but we're just a bunch of fans who love the local nine and talking baseball, including the 2016 World Series champion Cubs. Good evening, this is Ken. With me is Adam from Obstructive View. This is Oscars night, and we actually started just after they announced the best actor, and I'm pretty sure it's Cillian Murphy, but I left the room before they announced it. But there were a bunch of pretty standard wins. That Poor Things movie is winning quite a bit of, you know, dressing up the set type awards. And I was kind of happy that the American Fiction movie won Best Adapted Screenplay, because I kind of wanted to watch those movies, right? But honestly, the only movie I saw was the Barbie movie and Guardians 3, and I haven't watched a whole lot of other stuff. We did watch Ant-Man on the streaming, but Guardians 3, we actually went to the theaters because we really liked the Guardians. Did you watch any of these movies?
No, I'm so behind. I just keep watching when I get the opportunity to watch movies, pretty old and outdated movies. The last two movies I watched, no lie, were Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead and My Best Friend's Wedding, which it's from, I think, 97 or 98, and it's hilarious seeing Julia Roberts whip out her cell phone, and it's the size of a brick.
Yeah.
It's really good. I have some catching up to do.
Yeah, it was different from the bricks from the late 80s. Those were actual bricks. The brick that I had in college, I think, was the brick that Julia Roberts had. So it was a smaller brick. Now we have all this stuff in the palm of our fingers, and we're just, I don't know, idly scrolling by to see if the Cubs can sign someone else. But, you know, spring training is underway. As of this recording, tomorrow will be the first scheduled off day for the Cubs in Cactus League play. Hopefully that'll allow them to weather a few injuries here or there. We can talk about a bunch of things that have happened for the guys who have been healthy enough to play, including Christopher Morel at third base. We can try to take a stab at the lineup order, depending on whether or not guys are healthy. What we think about the pitching, rotation and bullpen. We could talk about stuff around the MLB, or just plain MLB, because if you say the MLB, people yell at you or something. Yes. And also the new rules. I think there were a couple of instances of the new rules, or a new emphasis on the rule being enforced as it's written. And yeah, the A's have a new stadium. I think you have opinions. So how's that for a plan?
I love this plan. I'm excited to be a part of it. Let's do it.
Sounds great.
Awesome.
As the spring gave away to summer, past the ivy-colored dreams, toward the days that kept us yearning for tomorrows.
Yeah, how about Morel? I think he's had a few errors here or there, but those are to be expected. I think they're actually going to give him the full chance to do it.
It certainly looks that way, especially with Madrigal, maybe not on the IL officially, but, you know, hamstring issues, you never know how long those are going to take. They're very nagging. So, yeah, it looks like the mushroom is going to be sprouting up in the third base hot corner. So should be interesting. He's very athletic. Very exciting, but not the most consistent.
Yeah, he just needs a little polish. I've always posited that all he really needs, given his athleticism, his range, his energy, his work ethic, was the reps. And they are giving him the reps. I don't think they've played him at any other position so far. I want to say that they might have played at second base once, but most of the time he's at third base. It's third base for third base. Someone else is DHing. They're just giving him as many reps as possible. And after he's done in the game, they're probably giving him even more reps. And then even before the game, he's getting more and more just practice to get the feel. And there have been some spectacular plays that he's made. There has been some of those, you know, we've probably said the same for, you know, David Bodie back in the day when he was actually with the Major League Club, and even Javi Baez and so forth. Like, they make the hard plays look very easy because of their athleticism, and then they just kind of botch the easy plays. And I think that might be a result of overthinking sometimes.
Oh, yeah, definitely. If you are in your critical mind, like your inner monologue, working your way through any sport, but especially I think making a throw where accuracy is everything, you're doomed. So yeah, the goal is to get him to the point where it just happens and he trusts himself to make the throw, and he's familiar enough with the mechanics and the timing and the infinite different ways that you can find yourself needing to make a throw to first. Yeah, hopefully those reps can get him to where it's all muscle memory and it's all second nature. Just have to see how it plays out.
My wife has informed me that Christopher Nolan just won for Oppenheimer for best directing. So yay!
Nice.
I still have not seen the movie. I know it's about a bomb. That's pretty much it. But you know, or yeah, making of a bomb.
I think I know how it turns out. I just don't know what the movie's like. It was kind of to stay with the Oscars, I should say, seeing Robert Downey Jr. Make his acceptance speech where you realize, oh, he really is just Tony Stark 100%. Yeah. Just a smart ass, quick witted dude. Yeah. Good for you.
But was he method acting when he was Tony Stark, or was he just like mailing it in? That's kind of the thing, right?
I think he's just hilarious, and I think he was pretty much being himself. And that's fine. That's fine.
Yeah,
because it was a lot of fun.
He made the MCU, and ever since he left, the movies have been kind of, but. I think they'll fix it eventually. There's like too much money involved for them not to fix it. Like, they're just kind of salamiing it, trying to fit as much content into the schedule as possible to squeeze every last drop of money out of us. Kind of like baseball, but you know, it's Marvel. Like, I think we're just kind of investing in the characters. But I think our favorite moment of the night was when Ryan Gosling did his thing and they actually got the other Kens from the movie to cameo. And that was really cool. John Cena naked was surprising, but I think he did it well. I think that was nice. So
yeah, overall, I'm surprised he didn't do the, you can't see me thing. Although if he had done it, then we could have. So I guess
I'm pretty sure he was wearing those like skin colored trunks or something, but yeah, that was well done.
It was as much exposure as you're gonna see on live TV.
So we're done with Morrell. He's going to be presumptively the third baseman. They're obviously not signing Matt Chapman because he went to a team that I completely forgot because it's been 84 years. I'm pretty sure he's Giants? A Giant. Yeah, I'm pretty sure he's a Giant. The Giants still might have some money left over to sign a Blake Snell. Snell and Jordan Montgomery are still on the market. And it's like, dude, it's March 10th. This is Mario Day. The season starts in 18 days. There's no time. What are you even doing sometimes? But that actually leads me to think about our own pitching outlook as Cubs fans and as a Cubs organization, because For the longest time, you were considering, okay, Justin Steele has been named the opening day starter. Great. We kind of expected that. Shota Imanaga is going to be probably right after him. He's been doing well. It's just working on that fastball location to try to not give up those like monster home runs. But he's been striking out everybody when he's been able to locate his pitches. That's just a thing. You know, locate your pitches, right? Kyle Hendricks is obviously there. Jordan Wicks pitched today, kind of piggybacking off Drew Smyly. He looked really good. So I think that's four. Did we say Hendricks yet? Hendricks would be, yes, be five. But
you said Hendricks. We didn't say Jimmy T, though.
That's right, because he has a back problem, and it apparently hasn't gotten better. So now you're just like, is this one of those just normal aches and pains thing, or is this one of those he's out for 2 months again kind of things? You know, it's kind of precarious for a rotation that has a lot of depth, but not a lot of eliteness to it. Like, it's serviceable. It will win you games. It just, is it going to strike fear in the hearts of, you know, the superstitious and stuff like that? No, I don't think so. So at that point, I'm just wondering, is there a way to swing a trade? Is there a way to just squeeze more into the budget to sign a Jordan Montgomery so you don't have to give up that draft pick now that you don't need, you know, to give up draft pick? And you also don't get the draft pick since you already re-signed Cody Bellinger. So now the, I guess, Caleb Killian's also out because he has a shoulder issue. So that's going to be a 60-day issue. So you can't count on him anymore. You basically have Drew Smyly, Hayden Wesneski, and Javier Assad, all of whom are okay in small doses. But, you know, Wesneski maybe, kind of maybe, can't get lefties out. Drew Smiley's prone to blowups, and Assad, you just don't know what you have. Like, he was great last year, but is it trustworthy, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it kind of makes you wonder if they need to sign the reigning Cy Young Award winner or a holdover from the reigning World Series champion Rangers. Like, how are these guys not landing jobs at this point? It's pretty interesting. But yeah, I would like to see the Cubs just go ahead and sign a good free agent pitcher and just, you know, make the pitching staff that much deeper, that much more reliable, and potentially even not necessarily a five-man rotation. You know, maybe it could be sort of a 5.5-man rotation, something of that nature, because the team isn't good enough to just piece things together all year long, or at least until the trade deadline. Yeah, you gotta make a move. So I don't know. I know Ricketts needs more revenue to be able to spend more money. I'm sure he's standing around going, What could I possibly do? How could I get another player on the team? My hands are tied. So maybe we could have like a bake sale or GoFundMe or something to help this needy billionaire come up with the money they would need to sign a player and still have their profits go up.
Yeah. And someone somewhere told me that the sports book that was being built on the corner of Addison and I think that's Sheffield, right? Addison and Sheffield, where the Murphy Globe was supposed to be, or what was it? Captain Morgan Globe, not Murphy's. Murphy's is at the other corner. That's the bar for the lady who passed away. May she rest in peace. But yeah, the sports book's open. Apparently you can start betting now. So there's your extra revenue, but will you actually spend it? You know?
Yeah. Can you place bets on whether the Cubs will add anyone of significance before the season starts?
I think they have prop bets for everything. I don't know if that particular bet is legal in the United States of America, but I also don't gamble on sports or period, because I always
we might be the two worst sources for this, because I've never placed a bet of any kind with a bookie. So yeah.
Well, I've never done a bookie, but I've been to Vegas and I've like put, you know, coins in slot machines and lost money at the roulette table. It's never like a debilitating loss or anything like that. It's just like, well, I just lost $20. I think I'm gonna stop now, you know, so that I can actually afford to go home. But yeah, that's something that's beyond my purview there.
Could it be a hero's moment? Could they somehow find a way? Will they rid us of these ghosts of shame?
I guess speaking of Vegas, how about that Sydney Opera House?
if you haven't seen it, you're exactly right. The Sydney Opera House comparison is spot on. That's kind of what it's made to look like from the outside. And then these renderings that they, you know, you have to assume they just spit through some sort of AI platform. The inside renderings don't appear to match what the outside drawings would look like. The dimensions seem off. It's very M.C. Escher. It just doesn't seem like all the overhanging sails really match up to where they're supposed to match up on any type of outline. It's showing no lights, although apparently I couldn't follow the link that you had shared the other day, but it looked like it was glowing green. Like, I don't know if the whole thing is supposed to be some type of LED screen that would light up the park, but it's not an enclosure. The design, if it's even a design, which I don't think it is, from big.dk, the architect's website, it's not enclosed. It's going to be in Vegas. You have to you would have to assume that they would be playing these games, if there are no lights, during the day when it's like 105 degrees outside. Like, I'm sure the shade would be appreciated, but they don't even have like very much park. It's limited parking around the stadium, which makes sense because no one would ever go to a game in the middle of the day in July in Vegas. Yeah, it just the whole thing is just so abnormal. Like, it looks like some architectural intern threw the thing together so they would have something ready by the time the meeting started with the mayor or whoever, and then suddenly it was published, and whole thing was just a fiasco.
That was the criticism earlier, is that like we were waiting for weeks or months for renderings after they had secured funding for the stadium through the city and the state of Nevada, but they just didn't have it. And now you're saying a bunch of things that everybody's probably thinking, like, this is a last minute project that they spit into like Dolly or whatever their latest AI program is. You can actually see where hands come out of nowhere and is put on someone else's shoulders. If you zoom in enough, like, you can see where it's AI'd. And I think the arch that you saw where it was mostly green, and then there was like the scoreboard and the player profile and stuff. So that's like, so you probably know about the sphere now. It's that big globe thing. That's essentially, sure, like the outside is a display with LED lights, and the inside is like the Omnimax theater that you might have visited at the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago, except it's much larger. So I think they're using a very similar LED technology across an entire arch, so that, like, you know, it's probably a very, very bad idea to blow up fireworks in Vegas where it's dry and, you know, the water is being siphoned from the Colorado River and there's not going to be much more unless you like borrow from the Bellagio or something, right? As for the transportation, I think a lot of casinos have monorail systems in between, but who knows if they're actually going to put in, you know, the investment to build a monorail from what used to be the MGM Grand. And it's probably still, I think they said they're on the old Tropicana site and the hotel is supposed to close in April so that they could demolish it and that they're going to build a ballpark there. But you I don't know if you've ever been to Vegas. I've been a few times, not for like 20 years though, like when I was younger and stupider, but it's a strip. That's why they call it a strip. Everything is along that entire road of like Las Vegas Boulevard. And I think the stadium will be there and the Raiders will be like somewhere close by, but it should be in close proximity to just about everything that the tourists want. And the casinos have so much parking that parking shouldn't be an issue. And now you just need to find a way to people move all those potential fans to the stadium, and that's it. But yeah, it does seem kind of lazy, right? Like it's like I get it as an AI rendering, but the dimensions don't seem to always match up. And until they actually revise the renderings, it's very similar to the first time in the convention that Tom Rickus announced, oh, we're putting in Jumbotrons, and everybody freaked out. And then when it finally was built, it's not so bad, right? But it's always the case with the rendering. So maybe they have a semblance of a plan. This would be like the first kind of plan that this ownership group has had with regard to the team moving to Vegas, if they did. But I imagine that they wouldn't like put shovels in the ground until they could like actually pinpoint every bolt that went into this thing so it doesn't collapse on somebody.
Yeah, the whole thing is very strange to begin with. I personally, I think it's hilarious that they already had renderings of a different design and then came out and said that didn't count. That wasn't real. It was just so you could have something to look at. Whereas this is totally real. I just don't get the impression that whoever put it together has ever so much as watched a baseball game. See, it's just amazing what a shit show the A's ownership has been putting on with the full support of Rob Manfred. It's just mind blowing. I don't use this expression lightly. Like people throw around that some of the Star Wars movies were an insult to our intelligence. I didn't see those movies that way, but this presentation of whatever the heck is going on and like trying to make it seem like any of it is in good faith, that, my friends, is an insult to our intelligence. It's a debacle. It really makes my brain short circuit to think that they think we're this dumb to think that it's good for the A's to move, that they've been any kind of genuine with the city of Oakland. Or that this guy who's running this team into the desert ground of Las Vegas is deserving of a major league franchise. I just don't get any of it. So it all just kind of makes me mad, from the ballpark to the moving the team in the first place to paying your team. I mean, what's the total payroll for Oakland right now? $2.5 million, plus
It's
three
a
food at
little more than
the food
that,
court.
but
But it's a little more.
it's
It's like a
definitely not
Dansby
it.
Swanson
Yeah,
away from
it is entirely possible that Dansby Swanson is making more than the entire Oakland A's club at this point. They don't have a lot of payroll, but I don't quote me on that. It's very small. It's like minuscule. It's even worse than the Rays, and the Rays are notoriously cheap, but at least they try to retain certain players that they want to build around, unless those players, of course, do something very, very, very bad, and we won't speak of that, but you know what I'm talking about. It's going to be very interesting. I know that they were talking, and we kind of discussed this in passing in the forum as well, about expanding into Nashville, and at least one or two people have been suggesting that the Triangle area in North Carolina, where Chapel Hill, Durham, and Raleigh are, is a better place to put an MLB club than the Charlotte area. So I would sort of agree with that. That's where the Durham Bulls play. I feel like they have a very good atmosphere for a minor league club, and I had a lot of fun when I went there. I know the mayor of Oakland has tried to negotiates in such a way that's like no matter what, if the A's decide to stay, or even if they leave, they retain the rights to the name The Athletics, because this is historically, like, I'm trying to remember if they were in Oakland much more than in Kansas City or in Philadelphia. And I think that has to be the case, because they've been there since at least like the late 60s, right? Because they won those two or three straight World Series in the 70s. So they had to move there before then. So that was like 50 plus years of A's in Oakland. That has to be the longest they've been in one spot. So it makes sense that they should keep the name The Athletics in that city, especially if they get a new expansion team sometime later, if the Giants stop being jerks about it.
Yeah, do kind of like the Cleveland Browns treatment when their franchise got moved to Baltimore and became the Ravens, rather than putting the Browns anywhere other than Cleveland and then giving them an expansion team and letting them, you know, maintain that brand. I think that makes sense. And if we do want to talk about expansion a little bit, I found myself shifting. I think there are two different issues going on. One is the issue of owners just tanking entire seasons for no purpose whatsoever, and there needing to be some sort of come to Jesus moment for the Major League Baseball ownership, where they say, look, you've got to field the team. You've got to do something. Like, if you're going to be paying your players a pittance of what we're giving you as revenue sharing, you better be competitive or you're losing your franchise. But because it just doesn't make sense for me to expand when you have 3, 4, 5, 6 teams losing 100 games in a year. That should just never happen. There's no excuse. You know, once in a while, if your team hits the skids and you approach that mark, fine. But when it's every division has a 100 loss team or close to it, that shouldn't happen. But that said, when we do have these scenarios where the players reaching typical free agent age start to get a complete lack of interest across Major League Baseball, you know, when you have a guy like, I understand Blake Snell has his problems, but when you have the Cy Young Award winner can't get signed, that's a problem. And I think it has probably come to the point where the replacement level player, the way that it stands right now, a replacement level player is probably way too good. A player that you can just pull out of your top prospects list is likely to be better than what a replacement level player should be. So you can get wins a lot cheaper with young, cost-controlled players than you can from the older veteran free agents. And it just seems like every team is going, yeah, that's what we're going to do. We can come close enough to replacing you with our younger players that we don't need you. And it just might be that the bottom level of that talent pyramid, where replacement level players should be right now, is just well below the total threshold for the number of players in baseball right now. So as a result, things are off kilter, and adding a couple teams might bring balance back to where you have replacement level player actually being a 4A player, which is kind of the way it should be. And if you want to see your free agent players who aren't Ohtani still getting paid what they have earned the right to get paid, you might have to open up some roster spots to kind of hit the side of the pinball machine, as it were, and nudge things along in the proper direction. So it's not an opinion I ever thought I would get, but when I was looking at, I saw some charts comparing or what the average age of a 3-WAR player was, like, or how many 2-3 WAR players are 30 years old and above. And it was like this huge peak of that type of player in the 90s. And then you've seen that number dip way down as more and more younger players are being responsible for the wins. And the immediate thing that so many people suggested was, oh, well, obviously that's due to steroids, which might have some validity, but I don't think it was only 30 plus year old players using steroids. I think it's actually much more likely that those numbers went right along with the expansion that happened in the 90s, that there was significant expansion in the 90s, which made older veteran reliable players much more valuable. And we just might be to that point where we need to open up more roster positions to bring the value back to these guys who, you know, the Jordan Montgomerys, Blake Snell, Chapman, Bellinger, guys who would be fending off offers from all around the league, who were just kind of sitting around going, does anybody want a 3-4 war player? Like, that should be a no-brainer, but it's not because of the balance. So, yeah.
So it's not so much diluting the player pool. You are diluting it in a way, but you're redistributing the talent so that more talent has more positions to fill, is basically what you're saying.
Yeah, that basically you shouldn't have an average player struggling to get a job in baseball.
Yeah, because right? Like, by average, it's like they should be on that roster, because an average player should be on an MLB roster. The problem is that you want to fill that roster now with Hall of Fame or All-Star or elite level players, and not everybody can do that. And now the front offices are kind of scrambling. And then you do have the tanking problem that you alluded to, like Oakland's not going to sign these guys. Maybe the Marlins will, but maybe they won't, because they have decided that we're not going to spend money anyway. So I don't really know what the solution is to that. I just know that you obviously can't have a deadline for free agency, because that strips away every single last bit of leverage that the free agents have if you do that. And I don't think, because of the immense amount of wealth being pumped into baseball, that you can have a salary cap. And in fact, like, it's impossible to reverse it now, because there's simply, they don't have the votes, but they should never have agreed to the luxury tax, hard tax in the first place. That was probably a death knell for them.
It's interesting comparing the state of the NFL since instituting a salary cap. The way that everybody spends, obviously it's a different sport, it's a different market, but you don't have teams who are just not meeting the salary cap, and the salary cap is going up in accordance with the revenue that's coming in. I think a salary cap would be a totally different animal if the owners were forced to, like any civilized society would require them to do, open up their books and show what their revenue actually is. But salary cap doesn't have to be horribly anti-labor, in that the NFL has no problem making sure that people compete. They have no problem making sure that every team is spending what they have to come close to the salary cap. There's no requirement that they get there, but they're competing, legit competing with each other to try and get into the playoffs, get into the postseason, make something happen for their respective franchises, and the players are getting paid. Now, granted, there's all kind of problems with guaranteed money in the NFL and all of that, but the fact that you can have entire teams who make less than a not outlandish contract to one player, it shouldn't be allowed. It's practically criminal, given the money at stake and everything involved. So where I would have 10 years ago said, yeah, salary cap is an absolute no-go, I would welcome it if it came along with, yes, we're a civilized society, we will show you our books, and when we talk about profit sharing, you'll see what our profits, what our revenues are, and you'll get an adequate piece of that pie. Because this shadow crap that they've got going on, where just any pseudo small market team can just say, yeah, we're not paying our guys that much, it can't happen. It's a sham. Yeah. Not real.
I do believe that they would need a salary floor. I think the issue is, like, the cap sports, like the NBA and the NFL, and to an extent the NHL, their guys have better endorsements. Like, the only reason I think Shohei Ohtani is just happy to defer 78 or 98% of his salary is because he's getting endorsements up the wazoo outside of baseball. Most players don't have that. Like, I think the last player that I can think of that had an endorsement that it was on my radar was Mike Trout shilling for Subway. And that's kind of boring in many ways. So I think they have a marketing issue. And that's why you see these exorbitant salaries, because they know I can't get endorsement money. Therefore, I must get as much money out of my owner as possible. So if they can market their players better, then they could better justify a salary cap, because they would be getting like additional revenue elsewhere. They can't do that now. Their only revenue is that paycheck.
Obviously, it helps to be insanely historically good. And those outliers are always going to have their money. My biggest concern is for the state of the game itself and allowing teams to exist without competing. It doesn't seem like too big of a investigation needs to happen to say, yeah, if you're in our league, you have to compete. Plain and simple.
Right. I think there's been kind of mechanisms in place to do that. They did institute the draft lottery. You basically cannot tank several years in a row and still expect a top six pick. So that's at least a minor deterrent. I don't know how much is going to deter them, because it's just going to be like, well, I don't really care about my picks anyway. I'm just in it to soak up the few $100 million of revenue and profit that I can get from just existing, you know, as a team. And there's the whole thing of how, you know, a product can market itself. Well, it's not going to do that for much longer, because, as you know, there's a lot of boner pill ads on MLB broadcast, because the audience is getting older and eventually a lot of us are going to die.
It's more than just a game.
That's a good segue into what they're trying to do. Like, last year was the pitch clock. I thought it was great. Like, the times have been ramping up, you know, throughout the season, which is why they reshifted the pitch clock. I haven't seen very much in the way of pitch clock violations. I think they were used to it. I think Shota Imanaga might have gotten one pitch clock violation, and then he like figured it out quick. The big new one, I think, is the running lane, which I don't think that's been an issue all spring. I haven't seen an article about that, but I've seen at least two possible bits for obstruction. One of them was with the Cubs for sure, and the other could have been obstruction, except the throw from the Cubs shortstop to the third baseman led the third baseman into the path. So if you can do that, like, you're not already in the path of the base runner, but you have to get in order to field the ball, that's okay. If you were standing at third base, like I think it was Luis Rengifo blocking the base from Christopher Morel as he was diving back in on a pickoff, he was already planted there. So that was obstruction. And I think the interesting thing about this isn't a new rule. This is just a re-emphasis of what's already been written. So I've feel like they should be able to steal more bases, and maybe that's been true, because the Cubs have stolen like 17 bases already this spring, and this game today was the very first time they had been caught stealing all season. And as far as I can tell, the Cubs catchers haven't been able to catch many people stealing, so that's kind of interesting from the catching standpoint. But yeah, it's the obstruction rule, I feel like, is going to be very key to player safety. And just, I don't know if it's artificial, but it's going to drive the steal numbers up, just like the bigger bases did last year. So they're really encouraging more action, more running, more balls in play and stuff like that. So hopefully that'll regain some audience. And then maybe with enough audience, now you get endorsement possibilities. And then we can explore this topic a little further down the line.
Yeah, I gotta say, this, yeah, not a new rule, but a new focus, emphasis on this rule. Part of my heart kind of dies. Like, I agree with it. I think it's the right thing to enforce obstruction, particularly at third base, I think is where it happens all the time. I know that because third base was my position, and I would do it every time there was a play at third. My knee would be going down, stopping. Like, I can't tell you how many guys I played, mostly in softball, a little bit in baseball, that I have tagged guys out at third with their foot 6 inches off the base and my knee clamped down on their ankle, stopping them from reaching the base. It is my favorite signature move. I love it. People hate it, and they always look at me like this, like, can you even do that? But they don't say anything to the umpire, to anybody, because it just looks natural. And at third, the reason you can do it more at third is because you aren't nearly anywhere near as far away from the base at third as you are when you're, you know, shortstop or second baseman coming into to second to tag. You're very rarely just sitting there waiting for the throw. I mean, it happens, but it's the angle just isn't the same.
Right.
At third base, you set up and you're not straddling the base necessarily. You got, you know, 1 foot on one side of the base, and your foot's basically making like a giant L on the outskirts of the base. And it just sets up so nicely as you're receiving the throw from the catcher. A guy's trying to steal third and just bending down your right knee right there across the front of the base, and you can block it. And it never gets called. I've never had it called on me. I've seen so many people look up at me pissed because I just tagged them out, and they came nowhere close to reaching the base. And it was a very easy call for the umpire to make. And as when you're tagging them, it just looks like, yeah, you didn't even make it to the base because the ball beat you. But sometimes the ball beat you. Sometimes my knee beat you, and then the ball got there later. But it all happened so fast. So it is something that's going to open up the lane. But God, it makes me sad because it's so much fun.
Yeah, when you did it, you were basically taught to do that because there was no emphasis. So that was natural. That was basically what you were taught. Now they're going to have to relearn how to receive a throw, because there's two possibilities. You're receiving it from an outfielder, or you're receiving it from the catcher, right? Most of the time, like every now and then you might get a pickup off throw from the pitcher, which is the one that happened with the Morel play. Like,
yeah.
There's got to be a way that you can time it or repetitively practice it such that you're just slightly off the line, but you feign the way you receive the ball so that it takes you into the lane. So you're not blocking, but by the time you have the ball, you can be blocking. And that's kind of the fuzzy zone of the rule that might be kind of like where, for the longest time, you didn't know what a catch in the NFL was, kind of thing.
Well, let me tell you, it's really easy to figure out how to do it without actually obstructing, because when you're playing with the occasional runner who's three times bigger than you are, you know exactly how to stay out of his way. It comes very natural. So it's something like not doing it is something you can learn very quickly without too much trouble. So it's kind of the same thing. You know, with the pitch clock, like once you get called a couple of times, you realize, oh, I got to change it up. So it's not a problem of not being able to do it or it taking too much strategy. It's just, when you realize that there are consequences, and when it's someone who's 300 pounds sliding into the base and probably over sliding, like, I'm not blocking that guy. Hopefully I can tag him. And if not, good job. Great. Excellent. We're keeping the offense moving and awesome. And I still have all my limbs intact and no concussions. So, everybody's happy. So it's definitely something people can learn and they can institute. And I don't think it's going to take very long because, again, as a third baseman, when you have a chance to tag somebody out of third, you don't want to pass it up. And so all it'll take is one, maybe for the real slow learners, two calls against you where you don't get that put out at third, guys will learn.
Yeah, you make a good point, because like literally those two instances are the only ones that I can think of where obstruction was very, very obvious and obviously should have been called that way. I feel like, you know, obviously the teams have more information, have more experience than I do. Like the old adage of they've forgotten more at baseball than I will ever know, probably true. So they probably practice it already even before the game started. So that this is literally why you only saw those one or two instances. Kind of like with the pitch clock, like for the first week of the pitch clock last spring, it was like everybody was triggering it. And then by the time the second week rolled around, there was nothing. And same with the regular season, it just kind of just kept ramping down as people figured it out. So they might not be good at math and science and stuff, but they're obviously very, very good at their jobs and they will figure it out. Yeah. So going back, we know that Morrell is probably the starting third baseman. We know that Michael Busch is probably the starting first baseman. The outfield is pretty much spoken for until we figure out what's going on with Ian Happ. Maybe he feels good enough to come back to a game after the off day, but we'll see. And then basically have to figure out what's going on with Tyone. But yeah, I think we have ourselves a roster. Who's your 26th man, the final guy on the bench? There's like several possibilities. There could be Wisdom. There could be Dominic Smith. And I think the last one is Garrett Cooper. Like they've already sent down everybody from the prospect core back to camp. Canario is still up, I believe. I believe he is still on the spring roster. So that's another one that I might have forgotten, and he's been hitting pretty well. So there's a number of possibilities, because you want, I think, Mastroboni to back up second, third, and shortstop, and maybe the outfield every now and then, and he's left-handed.
Maybe, but somebody wants. I don't, but okay.
No, that's fair. But Madrigal, you don't know if he's hurt. Bad,
right?
You know, and so his spot is in, I guess it's not in jeopardy for him, but it's in jeopardy for us because we need someone to fill that spot. So who's your guy?
My dark horse on someone who might make this roster that I didn't expect to is David Bodie. I don't have much of an explanation other than he's been hitting okay, and he is a guy who he has that versatility. And who knows? Like, I feel like if it were up to me, I would rather have him than Mastroboni. But it probably won't happen. I'm just, there's kind of that possibility that, you know, that switch could be made. And as much as I don't want to say it pains me, but I'm sure it will pain some people, I just have a feeling Patrick Wisdom is going to still have a spot. I don't have a real good explanation for it. It's just what my gut's telling me. But it really, I think, all depends on who is ultimately healthy and what kind of repercussions any of those health problems might have on what it means for the balance of the roster.
Do you actually know who's leading the Cubs in spring training home runs? Take a wild guess.
Is it Schrumpf?
He's actually tied for, I think, second. The one, so based on what I've just read, Schrumpf and a bunch of other guys are tied at two. That includes Michael Busch. The one who's leading with three spring training home runs is David Bodie. That means absolutely nothing because it is spring training, but I just thought that was interesting, and I would not have a problem with him doing, like, you know, the bench work. The thing with him is that, unfortunately, he is not left-handed.
Yeah. I had forgotten that he was hurt 2 years ago. And I just, part of me wonders how much of his struggle to, was it 2 or 3 years ago? However long ago it was. It got brought up in the broadcast today, I think on the radio. And, yeah, it's just something I'd forgotten. And just kind of wonder how many of his struggles or his failure to kind of launch last year at all, you know, failure to even make the roster or to make the big league club even for a day. I mean, I don't know what type of fine print issues there are as far as service time and all that. I can never understand that stuff. But I also wonder how much of it was him just not being fully healthy. So since that's always on the table as a possible issue, if he's healthier now, if he's indeed in the best shape of his life, he's not a bad guy to have on the bench at all, especially, you know, it was interesting him playing in left field. I don't know. It's a possibility.
Yeah. I think Dom Smith and possibly like David Peralta or Garrett Cooper, they'd have to be added to the roster. David Bodie would also have to be. Like, he can be. I don't think he has options remaining. He might have to be outrated again. But all of those guys, except for Patrick Wisdom and Canario, have to be added to the roster. So that's the difference. That's the rub. But I think, like with Bodie, because of the way his contract is set up, if he's outrighted, he can't refuse that outright or else he forfeits the money. So I don't know if that's based on what I understand from reading a bunch of what Arizona Phil has written. But over 162, while those guys can be important and might give you like a hero shot here and there, I don't think they're going to be in your everyday starting lineup. Like, just based on what I've seen so far, if Ian Happ were healthy, he'd probably be leading off. And if Seiya Suzuki stays healthy, he's probably batting second. And then it looks like Cody Bellinger would be batting third or fourth. So after that, I think he's just going to kind of mishmash the lineup, he being Craig Counsell. I have no idea what he's going to do with the lineup. I guess we'll see in the final week of spring training when the guys actually like start playing back-to-back games. They start playing like seven innings instead of five. And you actually start seeing like most of the regulars in the lineup together for the very first time all spring. So like we'll see by then. But just based on the early lineups, it almost seems like he wants Seiya Suzuki batting second for sure.
Yeah, I feel like I don't know that we even will at any point in spring training get a sense of what the lineup's really going to look like, because I don't feel like we've had a chance to see too many whole roster, you know, or whole lineup formations where it really looks like, yeah, these are the guys that are going to be hitting, you know, in this order or this spot every day. But yeah, I definitely like Seiya as a number two guy. I hope that's where he lands. Obviously, we have to wait and see when Happ is going to be back and in with regularity, because he's another, like, I don't know, but I envision him being, yeah, up there near the top. It'll be interesting to watch. It'll be interesting to watch how much it changes depending on the, you know, the platoon splits and all that. But it'll be fun to see how Counsell actually constructs a lineup. I'm anxious to see that aspect of the game start to make its way into things. Although it does seem like he doesn't put too much stress on all of the order and all of that, like trying to get sequencing exactly right. But yeah, that aspect of this season should be fun.
Indeed. And I think we can probably wait for another set of cuts before we really explore lineup and roster construction some more. But the picture is kind of getting clear. I think probably 23 to 24 of the 26 spots on opening day are spoken for at this point. And the rest will kind of depend on who else gets the unfortunate injury, which always happens. Kind of ban arms and bodies, because evolution wasn't very kind to us in that sense. It's just so fragile. I don't understand it. Like, it's a wonder that we survived for so long.
The beauty and the history in this cathedral, the sky so blue against the grass so green, like time stood still forever.
It was good talking to you. By the way, Oppenheimer won, like basically all the Oscars, so yay them, I guess. I guess eventually I need to watch that movie, although I guess I kind of also know what happened. But that's the same thing they said about Titanic. You know the ship was going down, but sometimes it's in this telling of the story to get from point A to point B. How are they doing that? Let's find out.
Yeah. Although I think the movie that might have gotten bumped up to the front of my Oscar list is probably Godzilla Minus One.
Oh, yeah. They did win an Oscar for Best Visual Effects. I really kind of want to see that because the American Godzilla versus Kong movies were kind of silly fun, but there's nothing quite like the original Japanese style Godzilla movies. They are just so much fun in the middle of the night when you're a kid.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And it's been a while since I actually watched one and not just clips here and there. So I have to see what steps I need to take to be able to watch it. But it did interest me. I loved their speech where I could barely understand, yet I could understand what they were saying. You know, like anytime someone's struggling to read English, so much so that you have to listen to every syllable in order to get it, it makes it so that the power of what they're saying kind of lands all at once. Mm-hmm. Because it's not until you hear every sound that you understand what any of the words were. And it just sort of, it all sinks in. And it's like, holy crap. Like the effort that they're putting, not in just communicating, but of the effort they put in for their whole lives to try and get to this moment and seeing them celebrate, you know, so much that their hands are shaking, trying to hold the paper and their like all their Godzilla models and, you know, their speeches and everything and their Oscars. And it's like, this is the coolest thing I've ever seen. So, you know,
that was pretty great.
Yeah. Yeah. Fun to watch.
I'm pretty sure, obviously, he's not a native English speaker, but he actually enunciated pretty well. I understood most of what he was saying, like there are others. And it makes me think that he had like katakana or something on his paper, and he was basically reading phonetically the Japanese pronunciation sounds in order to enunciate the English. And he did an excellent job for a non-speaker. So, no fun made. It was just like whenever someone makes an effort to speak in your own language, you just kind of have to appreciate it.
Hey, after I have taught English as a second language to Chinese students virtually, and you know, when I've made efforts to try and speak Mandarin to them, I feel like I'm walking on a tightrope over Niagara Falls. So I completely empathize with that feeling of, I am going to try to use my language's letters to make sounds that you might understand in another language. But yeah, it's rough.
But yeah, thanks to everybody for listening in to our post-Oscar show before the off day. You can find us at obstructiveview.net. And of course, you can find us on what remains of most social media hell sites. Our theme song is by Rich Deanna, and the final out call was pulled by Randall Sanders off the radio from Hall of Famer Pat Hughes. So, yeah, we'll see you after the off theme, after the next couple of cuts, most likely before opening day. Like, I'm sure we'll have plenty of talk about in anticipation of the first game that actually counts. Oh, you know the Dodgers and the Padres are playing Korea soon, right? So that should be kind of exciting.
Oh, wow. Okay, yeah.
They're starting the season like with a 2-game set that actually counts in Korea, and they're coming back to finish their spring training, and then the rest of the major leagues actually starts their opening day. So it's really weird, but it kind of makes me wonder if they should just like have all 15, or you know, when they expand 16 possible games, all in different countries, not the United States, so everybody plays on an even field and you really globalize the events. But that's probably something for way in the future. But it seems like it's kind of unfair for the Dodgers, but also kind of maybe screw you guys. Like, anything that disrupts your clocks is fine by me.
I saw a four-year average for the Dodgers, and every team's winning percentage over the last 4 years. And for the Dodgers, it was like 680. And then they went out and like improved significantly. And it's like, come on, what are we doing? Like, game still got to be played, but not terribly worried about making things unfair for them. And I think every team just kind of works in it. It's like, you know, when the Cubs played in Japan, or this past year, the wrinkle of going to London like might have messed them up for a little while. Maybe the same to the Cardinals, but it's just one of those things that you build in the extra day games, and hopefully it doesn't mess up your season too badly. Indeed. But it would be cool to do total global kickoff. That would be very interesting.
Yeah, I'm sure there were a bunch of like 2003 National League champion shirts in Africa, and it might be kind of fun to have like the Cubs play and Nairobi or something to start the season with those guys wearing their vintage shirts. But now that's a painful memory, and I think I've ruined our Sunday, so sorry. Yeah, but thanks again for hanging out with me, man. Go Cubs, and we'll see you next time.
I'm dead.
It was more than just a game.